So I want to continue. I want to get to talking about how qubits work and what we can do with them, mostly how they work. And there's an awful lot of pieces that we can explore in quantum devices. You'll see if you look at those white papers that we pointed you to, that everyone talks about the same few general things. We can have sensors, of course we have clocks. We can have communication systems. Hopefully we can have a quantum processor. And the quantum processor might be set up as a simulator, or might hopefully one day enable general purpose quantum computing. And the building blocks of all of these are going to be qubits. They're all going to have very similar performance. The complexity of the devices changes tremendously as you go through those. But today I want to start with the qubit piece and give us the tools for that. Now, there's a slew of modalities for qubits. And qubits are just a two-level system. We have a qubit. All we're saying is that we have an isolated, controllable two-level system. And, it might be isolated and controllable because it really has only two levels. I can take a photon and a Mach Zehnder interferometer. There's two paths, has two levels. I could take a spin one-half particle in a magnetic field. Really has two levels. Or it might be that it has a ton of levels. We could take two levels of a Rydberg atom. And so now we have a slew of levels, but we're interested in coherence between those two. And we have some reason to believe that we can keep the coherence only within those two levels. Or it might be a superconducting oscillator, which has a slew of levels again. And we would say, oh yes, I can create a system where only two levels are important. And you can see that if I want to create a system where only two levels are important, I better have some way of picking those out. So one of the things we're not going to do is to take a harmonic oscillator with a ladder of equally spaced states and try to pluck out two levels. Because the only way I could identify those is to keep going down to the zero level and count my way back up. So, here we're saying, we have some control elements. We're going to pluck out these two levels. Those are the ones we're going to use. Now, actually, let me try this. So you had quantum information science, and you heard of David DiVincenzo's requirements, and you want to remember when you think about David's requirements that they were put on really early in the field, and the way he, he identified the right things, but the stresses of how he identified them would be very different if he was to publish them today. And of course, he's actually gone through and updated them a few times. But let's see if we agree on these. And then we'll get back to one qubit. So the first thing for me is a Hilbert space with a tensor product structure. because I need to have control over that space. And if I can't make a mapping to a tensor product structure, then I don't have control. And I could take, for instance, a unary system, go back to the Rydberg atoms. Okay, I'm going to ask you. Do you guys know what Rydberg atoms are? Yeah, good, perfect. So as I go up in the levels of Rydberg atom, I have lots of levels. And I could say, hey, why don't I just make assignments and have my control there? Okay, and certainly I could span a Hilbert space. But I wouldn't have the control elements I needed to do error correction. And so we can't use that system of a single Rydberg atom to have a quantum processor. But I can take a whole slew of Rydberg atoms, and I can use each atom, two levels from each atom, individually as qubits, and make a processor, and use the dipole-dipole interaction between individual atoms as a control element. Okay. There's a lot of things where we end up saying that we have a sufficient amount of something. And we're still in the field trying to figure out what that sufficiency is. In some simple models, we know. In the full generality, we don't. And we need to be able to purify on demand. So one of the biggest challenges of making a quantum processor is to get the entropy out of it. You're always going to have a growth of entropy. And the way, at the end of the day, of course, we run quantum error correction. But when you run quantum error correction, you know, you have this step that says, oh, I'm going to throw away some information. So I've made a measurement on the ancillas, perhaps. I'm going to toss that away after I do some control based on it. And having some way of then repurifying those states and reusing them is an essential piece. It's pretty easy. At some point, you need to be able to measure something. You need to be able to go anywhere in Hilbert space, universal control. You know, these things were thought of as important in the early days. Those actually are pretty easy to get to. The part that we need to know especially for both of them, we need to actually do what we think we're doing with some small error bound. And we need to control that. And of course, control will come with errors. And even a measurement, you know, we tend to think about that as though it's just projective, it's along this axis. You know, it may not quite be projective, it may not quite be along that axis. You need low noise. But more than that, we need a distance with this challenge. You want to run error correction. And if every time I add a qubit, I add a new source of error for every qubit in my processor, then you're out of luck. So you need to have a system where as you're developing error correction beyond some threshold, beyond some horizon, you can say no new things will arise. And so you have some workable piece of control. You need to convert photons to something else. And you know, you might say, well, you need this if you're doing communication. But if I have a quantum processor, it's important that I can have interconnections across the processor. And so whether it's essential or not, we don't actually know. But it certainly helped, very helpful. And the last is often forgotten. You can't have a slow general purpose quantum computer that if you want to create interesting states over your system, you actually be able to have to do it fast, you know, at least fast to your lifetime or to, you know, how long we care about what the result of that calculation is. And quantum computers, as I hope you've seen, get horribly, horribly complicated. So we're going to need that. Okay, so this is my version of David's stuff, or this is David's version rewritten by me. This one wasn't in there. This one wasn't in there originally, but he did add it. And he would probably tell you that this one is in here. Okay, so I don't want to insist that there's something new here. And what we're going to do is to say, fine, we've got these pieces, right? These are our goals. We want to be able to control this. You know, eventually we'd like to be able to reach fault tolerance in some processor, which says that we can continue processing for a long time. It says we can continue processing forever, of course. And to do that, we're going to start by looking at what we can do with one qubit, which, you know, is already going to tell us at least about those. And then we'll see how we can reconnect. Now, as I said, we've got qubits and we have lots of modalities. So, you know, modalities are just what you're actually making the thing out of. And so we can have a modality which is a superconducting electronics. Could be trapped ions. Could be spins in or other defects in solids. Of course, it could be Rydberg atoms, as I said. It could be trapped neutrals. It could be quantum. Various versions of quantum dots. And if we wanted to, you know, we could fill all the boards with modalities that may or may not work. These three right now are the systems that we can operate at a level of about 15 qubits. But don't, it's hard to imagine we'll build a quantum processor that doesn't in some way involve superconducting electronics. It's hard to also believe that we're not going to find some way of connecting photons to the system. And therefore, these things become important. It's also difficult to imagine that we won't want some really long lifetime states in our processor. And it may be that at some point, superconducting electronics will deliver that to us. Today, they don't. And we can integrate other things. And so, you know, what you'll find as you go and look at the research in the field is there's labs that really focus on pushing the science and technology of individual modalities. And there's others that integrate those modalities together for some advantage. Okay. Now, I'm going to go over these things in some detail in later lectures. But let's just give a rough idea. So for superconductors, you didn't have electron superconductors.
No.
For superconductors, basically, we're quantizing the flux, which is the same thing as quantizing the currents in this device. And this element is a weak link, is a tunnel junction. And so you, for this, what you should imagine is you have some piece of aluminum, which is a nice superconductor, and you've grown on top of it aluminum oxide, which is a very nice insulator. And then you've put another piece of aluminum on there. And you've arranged for that oxide to be very, very thin. And so now then, here, I have a tunnel junction. So I have my wave function. And it's going to leak through. So that's that tunnel junction. And so the wave function, of course, has to be continuous around this ring. But because there's this change in potential for that tunnel junction, then I can have a phase. And so I can associate a phase change over that tunnel junction. And that's our control parameter. And we'll see this in terms of the Josephson effect a bit later in the course. But if I plot the potential as a function of phase, and so this is effectively an energy diagram, but I'm just plotting the potential term out to the Schrodinger equation as a function of phase. And what I'll find is that this will have terms that go as theta squared. So it'll be, you know, the effective of a transport of momentum term. And there'll be a piece that goes as cosine of theta minus, and here I have a parameter. I'll just call it alpha for now. But this is a parameter under our control. And it involves a bunch of fundamental constants and circuit constants. And so it's not that important to show you right now. This, of course, is periodic because it's measuring the phase over this junction. Okay, and so you would expect that as I change this piece, this phase difference or this potential, that I can control that. And so if I take alpha to be pi, then I have you'll have to forgive me for my lousy drawings. Well, you don't have to, but I hope you'll forgive me for my lousy drawings. We have a symmetric double well potential. And what I'd like is to think of the ground state as being the equal occupation of both of those. And of course, you know, this is a tunnel junction. If you calculated this wave function for a properly composed device, you would see that, in fact, the ground state is not this or that, but is having them both populated because this height, this potential height, is not that big. And in the nice world, there's only one other bound state here. And so now I have two qubits. I have two levels. I have one qubit. And then there'll be some states in this area. And of course, eventually we'll have states over there. And if I think about those states, I can think about them in terms of the flux that's quantized through the ring, or I can think about them in terms of the current that's rotating in the ring. And it turns out that the physics is that this well has current flowing in one direction, and this current flowing in the other direction. And so the ground state of the system is a coherent superposition of these current states with the current flowing in two directions, and that there's no flux in the system. All right. So now then we have the state zero, which is equal to this, and the state one, which is the same thing with a minus sign. And so here I have no flux trapped, here I have one flux trapped. And of course, as I create a superposition between those, I can control this, the direction of that flux, pointing in and out of the board. Coupling between qubits is conceptually easy because we have a magnetic field in the system. And so if I have two qubits next to each other, there'll be a magnetic field that I can control. And controlling the qubits is relatively easy because, of course, this phase just moves this over. And so if I set this phase to pi over 2, then I end up with one state for the lowest energy state. And so by the first experiments were done by adiabatically moving between these and then diabatically moving. And then later on, using microwave frequencies to directly address those two levels. Okay? So as I said, we'll come back to this. But there you have a good example of how you take a physical system and extract from it two energy levels that you're going to use. And as you do that, you can see that you need to control the physical Hamiltonian so that you get the eigenstructure that you want. Okay? We're going to need to think about how we add control fields so that we can do this as well. And I didn't tell you, it seems right now that this phase is somehow associated with just that tunnel junction. It'll turn out that it's easy to control that phase by how I bias the circuit. So we'll see that later on. All right. Now, as we continue, again, I'm going to remind you, when you have questions, ask them. Yeah, thanks.
So do people in like practice, when they build these things, have difficulty with like controlling the uniformity of the tunnel junctions when they make them? Because like you have to have your lasers like precisely tuned to like the difference in energy, and that depends on like how thick the tunnel junction is, and you have to manufacture that then with like really...
Great. So thanks for the question. So if I look at the growing a tunnel junction, you're exactly right that's a difficult thing to do. And one of the reasons we use aluminum for such devices is it's a reasonably good superconductor at very, very low magnetic fields, almost. We should like it to be at really zero magnetic field. But the main reason is if I take a piece of aluminum, then the oxidation step for it, so I just take aluminum, I've grown it in vacuum, and now I add a little bit of oxygen to the system. And then I'll start to grow an oxide on all the exposed surfaces. So we go from aluminum to aluminum oxide. And that growth of aluminum oxide has two nice features. One, it's self-limiting. So that, you know, if you buy an aluminum pen, then you see it's sort of dull. We've grown an oxide on it. But if you take something hard, the aluminum oxide is actually pretty hard. So, I mean, aluminum oxide is used for crystals. If you take something hard, you can scratch it and see the underlying aluminum is shiny. Okay? So this gives us a rate-limited growth, or self-limited. Let me call it that way for this class. Of a thin layer. And aluminum oxide expands. So it's amorphous and it expands. And so what happens is any defects it fills in. Now we try to use other materials for the oxide. You know, you can think of, let me take something like magnesium oxide, something that's crystalline. And when you create that oxide, it's beautiful, it's a nice insulator, but it shrinks and it might fracture. And then you get a small defect. If you're making a tunnel junction, the advantage of a tunnel junction is, of course, that you have this exponential sensitivity to the process. And so if you have a small defect in your oxide, then you can short out the entire tunnel junction. It doesn't work. And so so we use this exactly so that we can have a good tunnel junction there. And because it's rate limiting, it'll always be about the same thickness. So the control parameter we have is how big the area is. And when we write out the full Hamiltonian, you'll see that for a tunnel junction, there's a term that is the capacitance of that junction that will come in. And so we'll get an energy associated with that capacitance out of this. Now, when we build a superconducting qubit, we aim that for that energy gap to be in the gigahertz range. So a convenient level of the qubit separation. Is 5 gigahertz. It might be anywhere from 2 to 10, but it's under our control by how big we make the ring, how many tunnel junctions, what we bias with the capacitor and the capacitance of the tunnel junction. This interaction is controlled by a microwave field. So when I want to control the system, then, you know, here's one control method that says change the flux bias, which is a DC, which is changing the eigenstructure. But I could leave the eigenstructure right alone, and I could apply a microwave field. I write it out. And it's the magnetic part of that field, which I want to couple into the system. And that's going to drive the transitions. And so when you build a qubit, then one of the things you have to do is you go and characterize this splitting. And then you're going to set your microwave electronics to have that same frequency. And that we can do over a range quite well. Other questions? Right. Now, a real counterpoint to that is trapped ions. So now we take 4 electrodes. So if I'm looking from this side, these 4 electrodes would look like that. And I'm going to put somewhere in there an ion. And we'll alternate the voltages on these. And we'll do it in an arrangement that generates a quadrupole field. And so if I have a quadrupole field, then I can think of having interactions that look like this or like that. And it's a nice piece of physics to see that if you alternate between these, then you end up trapping your ion in the middle. And so now that I have an ion that's sitting there. Now, of course, these traps are long, and what we want to do is to trap a number of ions, and so there needs to be another weak trapping potential at the end, just to keep them confined in there. The magic is in this piece. This piece isn't so magic. You just need to repel the ions, and of course, they repel from each other. So you create a lattice of these. It's not really equally spaced, but that's okay because you can space them by some microns. And so we can shine a laser in to excite an individual atom. And of course, it's easy to detect individual photons. That, you know, your eye can detect individual photons. That's an experiment that was done many years ago of putting a bunch of students, undergraduates, into a dark room for a few hours and then turning on one photon and asking the students if they saw it. And of course, only one should see it. It's one photon. And you can build up the statistics and show that statistically you can see an individual photon. But here we're going to shine light on these. And we have electronic states. Now, the electronics structure of this is very complicated. Okay, we have a system which is effectively a one-electron system. We choose the atom, so it's a one-electron system. Everything else is in the core. And, of course, each atom has magnetic and orbital degrees of freedom, so there's many, many more things going on. But this energy separation between the ground state and the excited state is exactly precise because it's given by the electronic structure of an atom, and every atom is, of course, exactly the same. And so in this case, your question, you know, becomes simple. You say, oh, yeah, now then I have a well-structured system. I can control it. I can excite individual atoms. The challenge of how do I get the two-qubit gate, which we had up there as this magnetic-magnetic coupling between loops carrying current, over here, it's a beautiful idea of saying, take the laser, and I'm going to use the laser to push the atom. I'm going to use it to push this atom. And of course, by moving the laser frequency off resonance, then we can introduce a push, a potential to this atom. And we can push it away or we can pull it. And I could do that for two atoms in the string. And I can modulate them in parallel. I can have a collective motion of those two. And then the dipole-dipole interaction, the electric dipole-dipole interaction between these two, will be always constant because they're moving together. But the electric dipole-dipole interaction between everything else will be time-dependent and will be removed from the process. If we have time, we'll see the math of that later on today. And so here we can choose by which two atoms we couple, by our choice of which lasers we use to move them around and the way we push them, okay? There's still, of course, a spatial piece there that we need to work out, but it's not so bad. So if I contrast the two, on the superconductors, we have the freedom to build anything we want. On the we have the obligation, if we're building it, to do it right. On the trapped ions, we have the freedom that nature gives us a really precise quantum system to play with already. And the trapped ions, of course, we're going to put in a vacuum system surrounded by lasers. The superconductors, of course, are going to be in a low-temperature system with zero magnetic field, or as close to that as we can get. And then our control elements, although on one hand they're going to be lasers, on the other hand they're going to be microwave fields, the control electronics that generate the modulation schemes will in fact be quite similar between the two. and almost interchangeable. Okay, I want to talk about defects in materials and solids. And there's two important examples of this today. A phosphorus defect in a silicon crystal, of course, that's the basis of all of our semiconductor electronics today. So we have phosphorus doped silicon or other doping in silicon. Phosphorus is nice in that it's spin 1/2. And so we can use the phosphorus nuclear spin as a qubit, and it is an incredibly long lifetime. Silicon has an isotope that is spin 0. It also has an isotope, silicon 29, which is 4.7% abundant, which is spin 1/2. But it's quite reasonable today to make your devices entirely from silicon 28 if you want to. And even Intel has a line devoted to having silicon 28 electronics. And the so-called Avogadro project, the project to replace the kilogram standard, was a project that generated a beautiful sphere of just silicon 28. And so you can, since you don't grow a sphere, you grow a cylinder, you can get bits and pieces of that were left over from the Avogadro project. And they're very clean samples. Now, because we're putting phosphorus, which wants 5 bonds, in a silicon crystal that has 4 bonds, then there's also an electron spin that hangs out. And an electron is spin 1/2. And so here we have one really good low noise qubit. And then we have a second qubit that we can use for control. And this qubit is going to have a lot of noise. One reason is that the magnetic moment of an electron is 1,000 times larger than the magnetic moment of the nuclear spin. And so everything you do with a fluctuating magnet, the electron is going to see much more sensitively than the phosphorus. The second, of course, is that the electron has charge. And so it's going to be sensitive to any charge that goes on. And I should have said that this experiment is also a low temperature, at least modestly low temperature experiment, because you want the you want this to be an insulator so that the electron sits on the phosphorus. And so I need to be below about 50 Kelvin. You know, if I take a semiconductor has carriers because they're thermally activated. So as I cool a semiconductor, it becomes an insulator. And we want to be below that insulator transition. Now, the other system says instead of having a lattice of silicon, we take a lattice of diamond. And the lattices are the same. They're both based upon a tetrahedral structure. And in this case, we removed one silicon and we put a phosphorus. Over here, we removed two carbons and we put the nitrogen atom and then next to it a vacancy. And if I look at the electrons in that vacancy, or in this wave function, then I end up with two electrons from the nitrogen because there's a lone pair of electrons on the nitrogen, you might recall. Nitrogen's got three bonds and two electrons hanging out. And then here, this vacancy is missing three bonds, so there's three dangling bonds to carbon. So now we've got five electrons. And the hole's defect is negatively charged. So we have six electrons. But it looks like two electrons that are indistinguishable. And at some point in your quantum course, you saw that if you have two electrons and they're indistinguishable, that they fall into a triplet and singlet manifold. And we can look at that a little bit later. The fact that they're indistinguishable means that I can take the Hamiltonian and I can add a term to the Hamiltonian that says, exchange them. And then I can look at the eigenstructure under that Hamiltonian. And this piece ends up having one effective electron that is spin one. So over here, I have an energy separation for the electron spin that's big, but it depends upon the magnetic field because it's a spin 1/2 electron. So if the zero field, there's no energy separation. If I have a field of 3,400 Gauss, so Earth's magnetic field is half a Gauss, so 3,400 Gauss, the separation is 10 gigahertz. So this is the electron. And then each of these has a small separation. So this is electron spins. And these are the nuclear spins. Turns out they're the other way around. So there's a nuclear spin interaction between the electrons. Now this, of course, should be 1,000 times smaller than that, so I've exaggerated it. But we have this structure. The whole thing depends upon magnetic fields. Over here, I have the triplet manifold. So spin one says that I have MS is equal to zero, or it's equal to plus and minus one. And over here, I have the singlet state. Which is 0, 1, minus 1, 0. If you don't remember that, that's okay. This separation is given by the strength of the exchange interaction between those two indistinguishable electrons. So it's given by the material itself. And it's 3 gigahertz in the absence of a magnetic field. Now, of course, if I turned on a magnetic field, I can lift this degeneracy. But if we go through here, now this system, really clean, easy to control, but we need a magnetic field to describe the eigenstructure. Over here, we have a system which is not quite as clean, mostly because this six-electron state has some fluctuations to it. It's not quite as clean, but I don't need any magnetic field. It gives me a nice, well-defined structure in the absence of a magnetic field. And it's often described as though this piece is giving you the same thing as this piece, that you have a trapped, that you have a defect in a perfect crystal, and that defect can be the same everywhere. And so I can have atomic-like structures in a solid-state piece, and I can have more effective engineering of those. Easier to build a device from this piece than it is from that. To say that they're atomic-like is really quite an overstatement, every time you have a defect, every time you have a solid material, it's full of different defects. We'll see the result of that. But of course, in terms of an aspiration, it really is nice to say, oh, if we could take the advantage of this system, which is that it's perfectly reproducible as nature gives it to us, and put those into the solid state, then we'd have useful systems to expand our engineering control over. Of course, if we can take the superconducting system and control all the materials properties there, to have that system versatile and controllable, well, then life is great too. And so we end up having a set of modalities that we can build a quantum system of. And, you know, at this moment, I don't think we need to say, well, this one's better, this one's worse. You know, we do need to say, this one has the strength that it always comes in the same flavor. These have the strength of being truly small, and you can take them out in the world. I can make an NV center that I can wander around with, and still it would be quantum mechanical. This system has the advantage that every aspect of it is given by what electronics we actually put in place. Okay. Good. So unfortunately, we'll stop here.